Well, hello, listeners. Hello and welcome. Welcome to the next Words, Women, and Wisdom radio show. I'm your host, Yvonne E. L. Silva, broadcasting from Calgary, Canada. It's a bit snowy still out there. And this station, BBS Radio, airs live from California. And I'm here today with my special guest, Christine Skiff, who I will formally introduce in just a moment. If we haven't connected before, the Words, Women, and Wisdom radio show was born to showcase exceptional women, women who have typically risen from tragedy to triumph and are now out in the world doing really interesting things. And the show airs every couple of weeks. And the women that I invite, typically women who have I've met them through women's networks, maybe at the Women of Inspiration Awards ceremony I was recently at, but women who have been in my community. And I have been impressed with them. I've been intrigued by them. And in Christine's case, we have a lot in common. So I'm going to introduce my guest today, Christine Mayer Skiff. I know her as Christine Skiff. So I'm like, okay, this is the formal introduction here. So she's the founder and CEO, also a coach, the driving force behind an intriguing company called Gift and Author Publishing. And I'll let her share her story on that in a little bit. She has a passion for individuals, helping individuals tell their stories. She herself is the mother of not just one like me, but five special needs children. This is going to be an intriguing conversation, as well as a publishing powerhouse. So she has written, ghostwritten over 20 books, including 15 best sellers on Amazon. And her work covers all genres from novels and children's books to biographies, nonfiction, numerous articles and blogs, and specializing in transforming those typically mundane facts into really engaging experiences. So, humor, personality, captivating audiences, conveying ideas to bring them in relatable and compelling ways to the world. So she's the owner of Gift and Author Publishing. She's also providing indie authors and publishers with complete publishing services. So anything that could be traditionally done with a larger publishing house, from pretty much everything, writing, editing, illustrating, cover artists, marketing, she's got it all under her umbrella. And typically, those writers then maintain their own creative freedom and their own rights to their work. So, really interesting. So, today's show is all about the untold story of a special needs mom who is turned literary powerhouse publisher. So, let's dive in. Welcome, Christine. Where are you dialing in from today?
I am dialing in from Denton, Texas, which is in North Texas, right between Dallas and Fort Worth. And where you have snow, we have been in the 80s. So,
Awesome. Okay.
Fahrenheit here.
Denton, Dallas, Texas area. Excellent. So I'm hoping that we'll have a complete interview today. I don't have my special needs son with me today. It was his birthday today. He's actually at his dad's. We celebrated yesterday. And then your five are adults, so they're around, but probably not going to be jumping into the interview today, right?
No, they're not going to be in the interview today, but they are around. They're still here, and we're fingers crossed we're going to have a quiet, be able to get through this quietly.
Awesome. Well, I was really intrigued when we met recently in a women's entrepreneur networking group, and when you said you had five special needs children, my heart literally jumped because I know from my own personal experience, my son is now just 29. Oh my gosh! I know what a handful he can be, and part of that is a seizure condition, so it does make things a little bit complicated. His temperature is, temporal seizures, so. If the weather's fluctuating outside, he's impacted greatly by that. I just cannot imagine having five to be a handful for to be corralling. So let's dive into the story. I don't know if that is necessarily the tragedy to triumph part, or if there's something earlier on in your life that contributed to your rise, really struggling and developing extreme resilience even before you started having kids. But I'd love to hear your story.
So that is an incredibly interesting question. And I would have to say it's a combination of kind of everything. I am the oldest of eight children. My parents, now seven, my brother passed in 2018, my second youngest brother. And
Condolences.
thank you. definitely was, that was a hard thing. But as the oldest in a household where my mom wasn't always healthy, and I was the one who kind of took over and helped to raise and educate my brothers and sisters. And I think that developed in me early on a feeling of being the caretaker, of being the one to take care and be the one that's responsible. And there was some trauma in my past that I think developed resilience, you know, and also gave me the ability to, which isn't, it's going to sound kind of counterproductive, but it gave me the ability to separate myself from my emotions some. And when dealing with autistic kids, that came in very much in handy because they couldn't handle my emotions. Not necessarily the healthiest way to develop something, but you know, that's how you, everything comes, you know, comes around at some point. I, you know, I was a mom, not my mom. I was a young woman. I was writing. I had been raised, my parents didn't believe in television and all of that. So I was raised where all of my entertainment came from reading or writing. My brothers and sisters still talk about how traumatized they are that I made them act out plays that I wrote. One time I made my sisters do a talent show with me, and we did the whole sisters act from White Christmas. They haven't forgiven me for that yet, and we're now, I'm 47 years old, and I was 18 when I did that. But yeah, you know, we had a very close-knit family in that it was unusual the way we were raised, and that there were eight of us. And so, you know, with a 10-person family, it meant not a lot of money, but a whole lot of people and a lot of fun. We were the house everyone came to kind of have dinner at and play and, you know, all those kinds of things. Then I was in a relationship that went kind of weird. And he started stalking me. And so after dealing with that, I decided I needed to start over. So at that time I lived on the eastern shore of Maryland, and I moved 500 miles away to upstate New York, in a little town called Lima, right outside of Rochester. And I went to a Bible school where I met my husband. I was not looking for a husband at the time. I was actually kind of over men. I was done. And a year and a half later, we were married. Our first year of marriage was very difficult. Very, very difficult. I felt like I was going insane because I would say I went to the store and I spent $40 and I'd actually spent 41, and he would say I was lying. I gave a time frame where I'd say, oh, it's 6 o'clock, but it was 6:13. That was like me not telling him the truth, and he felt he had very different ways of thinking that when we were in a dating relationship were not as much of an issue until we were living together, and they became issues. For the first few years of our marriage, I felt like I had lost my mind because nothing I could do was right, because I was felt like if I agreed, he felt I was being patronizing. If I disagreed, I was being argumentative, and if I was quiet, I was being, you know, obstructive. So I was like,
This is sounding very familiar. I'll tell you more later. Yes.
and
Okay.
so it was very difficult the first few years. We went to marriage counseling, assuming that that would help, but it made it worse because what we did not know at the time, and the therapist did not know at the time, was my husband was autistic.
Oh.
And so he was treating our issues from a neurotypical standpoint, not understanding we were not dealing with neurotypical issues. We were dealing with a neurotypical and someone on the autistic spectrum and not knowing how to communicate with each other.
Wow.
And so we quickly had kids. We had all five of our kids in the first 4.5 years, but four of them were in 2.5 years. So I had a, when my twins were born, I had a 2.5 year old, a 13-month-old, and infant twins.
Wow. That in itself is a lot.
Yes, it was a lot at the time, a whole lot. My oldest, we had, he was different, but he was different in such an accelerated way. And he taught himself to read before he was a year, you know, simple reading. And he was climbing. I have a picture of him climbing stairs at 4.5 months old because he taught himself to crawl before he was 3 months old. So the fact that he would only sleep on white sheets, that he had to have the exact same bedtime routine, that he would only, you know, that at a year he weighed less than he did at 5 months. I mean, that was the biggest thing that we were concerned about because he wouldn't eat. He would, if he did eat, it was, he had three foods he would eat: hard salami, he would eat raviolis, but they had to be Chef Boyardee, and he would eat blueberries. And that was, and occasionally we could get him to eat an M&M or something, but the raviolis had to be four raviolis, and they had to be cut into fourths. You could not give him three raviolis cut into fourths or four raviolis cut into thirds. It had to be four raviolis cut into fourths, and it was like that. But because he was so advanced, we just kind of accommodated. You didn't really think about what you were accommodating. He was just kind of perky. You can handle, other than the health issues of not gaining weight, everything else was just kind of, oh, that's just Paul, he's quirky. You know, that comes with genius comes, you know, kind of quirkiness, you know. Then my second son was born. And you know, he seemed like he was more normal. He would take your face and he'd turn it to you and he would look you in the eyes and he wanted to interact with you, whereas Paul just wanted you to listen to him, and that was it. He really didn't want any, he didn't like being touched. He didn't want any kind of communication from you unless it was intellectual. He was not a snuggly baby. I found out later on when I sang to him to calm him down, I was actually torturing him because the sound of my voice, the pitch of it, was just at that pitch that was sense with his sensory issues was the wrong thing. So as a mom, I'm thinking I'm helping, trying to calm him down, and I'm torturing the poor child. You know, every mother sings. So we go and we have Sam, and then we have two, our twins, and that is when things really kind of came into focus. As a young adult, I had worked with stereotypically at that time autistic young adults, and you know, they were what you saw in the movies, the flapping hands and the rocking in the corner. It was more of a stereotypical thing, not what you would see now that we understand autism as a spectrum. So when my twin Jamie, they're Jamie and Alex, when he was born, he didn't want to be touched. He didn't want, we thought they'd want to be in a bassinet together and do the whole twin thing. No, he wanted, he never really looked at you. And he started to talk, but then he stopped and he reverted. By the time he was 18 months old, he would scream 12 hours a day. And the only way I could calm him down was to rock him and sing to him. With him, singing wasn't torture, or count to, or count in a monotone voice. And sometimes we got up to 300 or 400, and he would calm down. This was such obvious behavior that this poor child was suffering. And so our pediatrician at the time was named Dr. Kirchmeyer, and I call him our angel because he was this old, at the time we lived in Virginia, where my family's from, and he was this old time, probably delivered three quarters of the Richmond, Virginia area in their grandmothers, and he knew everything about babies, and he didn't tend to overreact. and he knew everyone that was available. And he had this deep smoker's voice, which I thought was hilarious. So he came and he said, "I think he's autistic." And I said, "I guess I can see that. I've worked with autistic adults before. I could see that."
Right.
And he sent us to one of the top pediatric neurologists called Dr. David. He was in University of Virginia, and he looked at my son, and he looked at all my other children, who at the time I was not so worried about because you have this extreme thing going on. I'm also pregnant with my fifth baby. And he said, "You know, I think he needs to be on anti-seizure medication." He had never had a seizure that I knew of at all. And honestly, with this level of autism, you may want to consider, as he gets older, to institutionalize him because you're not going to be able to handle him. And I'm like, he's not even two.
Wow.
You're giving me your child is never going to amount to anything, and he hasn't even hit 24 months. I can't accept that. I won't accept that. So I went back to Dr. Kirchmeyer, and I was pretty, upset. And I said, "You know, he says he's autistic, like you, and I can accept that, but I can't accept that at 24 months, not even, my son has no future. I can't accept that. At least we have to try something." He was very connected in the community, and we lived in a town called Glen Ellyn, which was on the west side of Richmond. And they were, it was, we were poor as church mice, but we happened to find the one house in the area that was run down and rentable. And so we lived in an area that had a very, very prestigious public school system. At the time, and you're talking 2003, 2004, every student was already receiving a laptop. All these things that, they had so much money in the PTAs at some of these elementary schools that they literally didn't know what to do with it. And
Wow.
so we did not belong there. As all the other mothers are talking about their au pairs, I'm thinking about, are we paying electric and buying groceries this week? I'm not quite sure, because we had met at Bible school, if you remember,
Yeah.
and that does not pay the bills. And so we had to kind of readjust. And my husband was building his career as a computer programmer. He had done it at 8. We will get into my husband in a minute. So we, at that point, I'm trying not to take up too much time because this is quite the story, but we started, my Jamie went into their flagship autism program after going through the process of acceptance. By the time he was started, he was about just over 2 years old. By three and a half or so, he started to talk,
Oh,
maybe four.
wow.
Not completely verbal, but when he started talking, it wasn't like baby talking, it was complete sentences that started coming out. Because it had always been in him, he just couldn't verbalize it. And he started to talk in the third person. Actually, he started first to talk through a stuffed animal that he carried around for years. He carried different stuffed animals around. And he would say, "Bunny want a drink?" Or, "Bunny want Batman," because they love my kids. That there was a cartoon of Batman, and it was had darker colors, and it didn't overstimulate them, and so they liked it. At the time, I didn't realize that what it was. They just liked Batman. So we would put on Batman or whatever, and then it went to, "Jamie want a drink?" And when he was about 4 and a half years old, he came up to me and he said, "Jamie broken."
Oh.
And my heart just about shattered as a mom. Because in this little tiny baby who was so beautiful, he had been feeling the difference and feeling like he was broken. And that just shattered me. I was like, no, baby, you're not broken. You're not broken.
You're
You
special.
you're special. You've got amazing gifts. I mean, because, and he does. By five, we had finally potty trained him. It was a long journey. Potty training all of my kids was very difficult. For him, it was especially long. And we were now having to move out of that, out of Virginia. My husband's job, he had kind of worked his way up and to where he could, and we needed to find a new job for him where he made more money. We lurked around, we looked around, he interviewed all over the country, and we ended up in Texas. It was quite the journey going, and we moved from one of the most prestigious areas for autism down to a small town in Texas where I was told my kids could not be autistic because they didn't have a program for that.
Well, excuse me.
Right. And I,
Amazing.
being the woman that I am, said, I didn't realize moving to Texas cured autism. If I had known that, we would have done that years ago.
Brilliant.
Right.
Sounds like something
Wow.
Oprah said.
Right. So I had skipped over in that part. My oldest went to kindergarten up there, and he had, when he went to kindergarten, where most kids come in and it's really difficult for them, but they kind of get it, they get used to it and they kind of get into the swing of things. He just got worse and worse. He could not handle it. His kindergarten teacher, we were blessed because she had just come out of being a special needs teacher and gone into general populations. And she pulled me aside and she said, "Hey, Mrs. Skiff, I don't want to worry you, and I don't want to say this, and I've kind of debated telling you this, but I've been a special ed teacher for 20 years, and have you ever heard of this thing called Asperger's?" Now, I was dealing with Jamie being diagnosed as autistic, so I was in the middle of research. I mean, as a special needs mom, you know this. When you start getting those diagnoses, you start digging in, and you're like, "I'm going to learn everything. I'm going to get it right," you know? And I was like, "I have." And she said, "I really think he has Asperger's." And I said, "Well, I can see that." So back to the diagnostician we go. We get the diagnosis. Now we have two of our five that are on the spectrum. In that meeting, the doctor said, "You do realize your husband's on the spectrum, don't you?" And I said, "Oh my." Everything suddenly made sense. All the, "I'm going crazy. How do I communicate? Why can we not connect?" All of these things suddenly made sense. And I often say, and it is the truth, that my kids being diagnosed saved our marriage, because as I learned to communicate with my children, I learned to communicate with my husband. And my husband is brilliant. He's not, that's not like really like proud wife speech. No, he is actually brilliant. In kindergarten, he went to his much older sister's senior chemistry class with her all the time, and he did the work and was able to pass. He's very, very, very intelligent. His whole life, he was like, everyone would tell him, "You're smart. There's something wrong with you. We don't know what it is." You know, and they didn't know how to teach him. So we moved to Texas, and that's where we're at now.
I'm like amazed and horrified at the same time that there is such a difference in the availability of programs between one city and another. And at the same time, with today's virtual technology, I'm hoping that some of those amazing programs that you were able to access early on could be more available to other locations now. Have you kept updated with that? Because obviously that was a number of years ago, right?
Well, I think, yes, we're talking a number of years ago now, but COVID kind of brought some of that. But the issue here in the United States, and if you think from Texas to Virginia is a difference, we moved to 10 miles. I'm trying to shorten the story, but within that, we moved 10 miles within Virginia. And we went from a school that had everything with kids being given laptops to when we started school in that district that was 10 miles away. The math teacher didn't even have a curriculum. There was no books in the library. And those students are expected to be able to compete with the students coming out of the other district for scholarships, for being able to be in, for spaces in college, for to
Wow.
be, the American education system is not, there is no equality. It is based upon tax brackets.
Wow.
And if you have a higher tax bracket, you have better schools.
Yeah. So when did you get to a point then where you were able to really step into your own? Because obviously all of these experiences would have built up tremendous resilience. When did you start the publishing firm? How did that get started?
I call myself an accidental publisher. So in the process, as you well know, as a special needs mom, childcare for kids with special needs is astronomical. It is astronomical. And so having five, I did work while they were in preschool because they needed preschool, especially with autism. They needed to be have socialization. But the joke was, and it was the absolute truth, that I worked and I couldn't even afford a cup of coffee because by the time I paid for childcare for the five of them, I had exactly $1.75 left of my paycheck. So I was literally paying, I was working to pay for childcare, but it was it was so important at that time. But after that, I couldn't afford to work. It cost more than I could make. So I stayed at home. I was a stay-at-home mom. And I needed an outlet. I needed an outlet because, I'm at home with five kids all the time. I need to talk to grown-ups. So I started writing a blog about our experiences, and it got sort of popular. It's called Glimpses of Skiff. I don't publish to it as much anymore, but the old blogs about our experiences with the kids as they were growing up and stuff are still up. And they were very stream of thought. As a stay-at-home mom, I did not have time to do a lot of editing, so you get what you get when you read them. But they became popular because our experiences were kind of unique, and I tend to view things from a comical point of view because you either laugh or you cry, and a lot of times it's perspective. And if I can, I choose to laugh. So I was writing this blog, and everybody's like, "We love your blog. You need to write a book." And I'm like, "I need to take a shower and not have someone interrupt me. That's what I need right now. A book is not on the horizon at all. Maybe later." But the kids did eventually start to grow, and there was a lot of fighting for education and all those things, but they were in school, and I was able to start writing. And I did write a book. I had been working on and off for it for 10 years before I finished it because that's all I could do. And everybody's like, yeah, we can't wait. And then I publish it and they're like, this is great, but what is it? And I'm like, because I did not write the book about autism or mental illness or all the other things they thought we were going to address. I wrote a psychological thriller. And they were like, where did that come from? I was like, I wrote a book to have a break for my life. So a friend read the book and she's like, I had no idea you were a writer. And I was like, yeah. And she said, I have a business where I do ghostwriting and I have too much work. Would you be willing to take on this one book? And I said, you know what? That sounds like it would be finally something for just me. I would like to do that. So I took it on. My first ghost written book was 30,000 words and I made a full $200. Yeah, and I was like, it felt good to make $200, but I think I need to figure this out better. I did continue to ghost write, not at $200 for 30,000 words, but not a whole lot more. But in 2.5 years, I wrote more than 25 books, and a lot of them went to bestsellers in Amazon. And as we all know, that is more about positioning and stuff, but but there was also a fact that they were well received. So, But as I'm doing this and having had experience with writing before I had kids, I'm now coming into this position where I left 15 years ago and I'm or 17 years ago, and I'm coming in, and self-publishing and Amazon have totally changed the landscape. Everything changed. Anyone can be an author. It made, an equal, it leveled the playing field in some ways. Yes,
Yes.
and I love it. I love it. But at the same time, it opened that world to a lot of scams and a lot of people who said they could do things who could not. And I'm like, I wanted a team I could trust. So I built my own team for me as an author. I did not build a team to be a publisher. I built it as an author so that I had an editor I could trust who could actually edit, that I had an illustrator who could illustrate and a formatter, et cetera. And so I'm building this team, and suddenly people are coming to me. Hey, who are you using for this? How do you do this? Why are you doing, what is going on? And after about a couple of years, I realized we were publishing. And the team had
Actually,
grown.
I have someone to refer to you. I'll do that. I'm just making a note. Yes.
And we were publishing, and so I kind of it was just kind of life, the domino effect. But now my team has expanded. It's going well, and I am so lucky because I get to spend each day being incredibly inspired by amazing people, because people who tell their stories are they're just the way that they have overcome adversity, the way that they have grown businesses, or whatever their story, even children's stories where they're sharing some type of experience. I just who gets to do that all day, every day?
Love it.
That's amazing.
Love it.
And so I don't get to write as much. That's the kind of downside. I love writing, but I'm hoping to take a vacation next year and be able to do some writing. But
Excellent.
I do love what I do, and that's how I got here.
Excellent. Well, that is part of growing a scalable business, right? So as you know, and the listeners know, my background being an executive coach, so typically had or not typically, but had three main phases to my career. That's how I ended up in Canada, was coming from England to Canada with a British educational company who was hiring and training sales reps. So did that. That's what got me here. And then I ended up falling in love and staying with birth of my special needs son, who didn't know his special needs at the time. But much like you, I had that experience later on at daycare. I'll share a bit on that. The second phase was all about working with an IT, high tech, high growth startup, and then several others that were in the IT and telecom field, and moving into an HR role and expanding until I was a VP of a global talent management firm. And then the last phase in the last while has been working specifically with women entrepreneurs as an executive coach. So helping women entrepreneurs to scale their businesses, either by using that HR experience of hiring about 6,000 people to help them to hire their team, grow, expand, do the work through others, inspire, engage, and lead them. Or to get more sales and use their language and their words more powerfully. So that was how my book got formed. Words, Women, and Wisdom: The Modern Art of Confident Conversations is the book, and it's 40 different words and word concepts to help women to ask for what they want and get it, not by being pushy and aggressive, but by using their language to articulate their value very clearly, very specifically, using the power of pause or not, depending on the situation, certain words to add in or to leave out. And the background of those three things, all wrapped up around having a special needs child, I know has contributed to my own resilience. So as you were sharing some of your story, I'm like, yep, oh yeah, been there. With my son was two, just over two, and he hadn't been walking. He'd been delayed in all of his development. They said to me that they weren't sure if he would ever walk. I was like, heck no, he's gonna walk. He just might be a little bit later in his walking, and he didn't start crawling and walking until he was two and a half. And so Okay, but he did it, and he was always, as a kid, very clunky and cumbersome, and didn't have a very straight gait. He was always sort of lopsided, and now has a bit of scoliosis, but he walked. It was like, oh yeah, he's gonna walk, and I'm gonna do everything that I can to support him in making sure that that happens. My experience similar to yours when you got told about your husband being on the spectrum was 6 months. 6 months in, I'm done maternity leave. Like you, I'm like, I'm climbing the walls. I need to talk to real people. I need to go back to work part time. Sorry, I'm talking about him and he's calling me. That's so funny. that's Alex. Took him to daycare, and at the end, when I went to pick him up at the end of the day, the daycare director pulled me aside, and it's like, dear, I just have to mention a couple of things. You might not realize this, but by now your son should be doing this and he should be doing that, and I'm concerned that he's special needs. And I was like, because I didn't know. I mean, that
No.
was my first child. They don't come with a manual. My friends had baby girls, and at that time, I just assumed, because we know that boys develop later than girls or take longer, that there wasn't anything to be concerned about. So I left I had left him at the daycare, and I was bawling because I was, sad to be going to work, and he was crying and I was crying. And then I was crying all the way home as well because of what she had shared with me. And that was quite a shock. So the insight put us on a whole different trajectory, because then we were starting to, have regular checkups and dip into different programs and start looking at available funding, because we knew that when we were looking at daycares, there were going to be special needs daycares, not just a regular daycare where the ratios were off. You can't have a special needs kid and have like 20 kids to one teacher. That just doesn't work.
Park now.
And so, that started, and then at a year old, he started having seizures. And then we started doing all the medical pieces to then see on an MRI what his brain physiology looked like. And you could see clearly why he was having some of the challenges he was having, and had four surgeries before he was five. So it's been a journey, but I just had all of my energy concentrated into one kid. And that was partly why I only had one child, because there was so much needed for that one child. I just, I say, I'm so in awe of your capacity and your resilience developed by being able to collaborate and coordinate and look after five kids, five special needs kids. The tail end of that story, though, is when he was around 18, he came running into me, "Mom, Mom, I need a credit card." "Okay, sign of financial independence, this is good. What do you need it for, honey?" "I need to buy a kid a smile." "Like, what? I don't get it." So he pulls me into the living room, and he's watching an Operation Smile telethon, and I've been told, you need $250, or you put it on your credit card and make payments. So he wasn't sure if he had $250 in his bank account, so he needed a credit card. And of course, the bank doesn't know what to do with a special needs application for someone who's not quite 18, is going to be on government funding, he's not going to have a regular job. So it goes in the C pile, never comes out. Three times later, never comes out. So he's getting impatient then. "I'm going to sell my artwork and I'm going to raise money that way." So that's what he ended up doing. So his book, Christine, was actually out before mine. I put his book together, which is actually a compilation of all of his, well, not all, but his top 12 most popular, most commercial pieces of art. And he's raised enough money to have five cleft palate surgeries paid for by his artwork, and super proud of him. So when
Gosh,
someone believes in you, it's incredible what can happen. And I'm hoping that at some point we might be able to get back to maybe him and I going out to schools and talking to kids, probably 6 to 12, like regular kids, and just asking, what are you doing in the world for other people? Because there's so much social media on my cell phone, insular, don't even talk to other people at the, cafeteria, that I think we've lost ourselves. And a lot of times our kids see us immersed in technology as adults and they follow suit. And so there's a lot more that we can be contributing to the benefit of humanity when we actually take a step back. And so I'm super proud of him and hoping that his seizures will settle down a little bit soon, that we can actually get back to that. So.
That is an incredible story. Oh my gosh. I love A, his heart for people. That just shows just how much you've raised him, with the values that people are important. And I love that he took his talent and used it to take care of other people. Oh my gosh, that's amazing to me. I did want to say that with the case of Jamie, because I did go into what the doctor said, Jamie did indeed graduate. He went through high school. He had went through the JROTC. He is a math genius. I don't understand the math he does, but he loves it. He does speak. When he's stressed, he goes back to being a little bit nonverbal, but only then. And he is an incredible guy. And he's just so compassionate and sweet. And I think that it's easy as parents to just say, okay, I'm going to take that and just write it off. Write off, where the doctor knows everything. And, but instead, to, as a parent, I think it's so important to evaluate and find the things that are going to work for your child. Because even if your child doesn't go to what they the normal route, they're still capable of so much. And to put the limits that we put on anyone with special needs, it's unfair to them because they have so much to give. Like in the case of your son with the smiles, I love it. I do.
Yeah. Well, I think that, as a, kids can be so cruel, right, in school, when someone is different. And yet when there is a there's a certain point where the line, the kind of crossed over the line, it's like, okay, clearly this person is different because they have some physical or specific challenges. It's not that they're weird. They're clearly different and they can't help it, right?
Right.
I think that that's when we seem to be able, or kids seem to be able to bridge the gap. And so
Science.
there's room in the world for everybody, right? Not everybody wants to be organizing, shopping bags, right?
No.
Or sweeping floors, or whatever it might be. But for some people, it brings them great joy. I remember Alex going, my son is Alex too. I remember him going to do a little job exercise when he was in his grade 12. They did like a work term, and he went out to the local Sears, and he spent the whole afternoon taking all the ties, men's ties, and arranging them all like a rainbow spectrum in color, all around this round podium. And it was beautiful. And the manager was so thrilled. And I mean, yeah, people kept coming up and wanting to buy a tie, and he'd like, rearrange it again. But I mean, nobody else typically who is a able-bodied person would want to spend the whole afternoon arranging ties, but someone's got to make those displays look attractive, right? And
Absolutely.
those metal wire ties that they put around like expensive boxes of saucepans and stuff with magnets on them. Like, who wants to have a bag full of those and sit and untangle them all afternoon? Certainly not me, right? So there is room for everybody in the world, and I really want to encourage, that's why I was so delighted to connect with you and hear more about your story. There is so much more that we can do in the world when we look through the lens of compassion, when we consider that humanity is made up of all different people from all different walks of life. We all have different gifts, different abilities. I love coaching because I love seeing that, I see when people get it. And it's not about me telling them, it's about me holding space and asking them powerful questions so that they can discover their own answer. Because when they have a solution and they take action on it, then they're more committed to it than if I told them, like, that's mentoring. Yes, here's how I did it before. What do you take from that? What could you do? Here's a way to do it. But when I ask, they have the power to make the decision, how fast they want to go, how much they want to risk, how quickly are they going to take action, who that's going to impact in their life around them. And that's not for me to decide, that's for them to decide. So it's super powerful. The other thing is about, you had mentioned earlier about the experience that you had, and I had a similar experience with my dad, who I thought he was just an angry man, but it turns out that going through World War II and getting a bullet in Dunkirk, he was actually PTSD, and he just could not express what he was really feeling. And hundreds of thousands of men came back from World War II and they just did not have the capacity to give them all treatment. And so that's how it showed up with him being a very angry man, not patient. 5 o'clock came, and if you weren't home at 5 o'clock, the dinner was not on the table. My mum was, A, in trouble, and she was in trouble so much she lost her voice because he criticized her so much and she just lost her dignity. And very often I wouldn't get to eat because I was like the adventurous kid and I was not home at 5 o'clock every day. And it's interesting how when we have that understanding and appreciation, we can be more tolerant, be more tolerant about accepting and saying, okay, so that's how that person is. Not because, again, of any intention to be mean or underhanded or whatever. That's their personality type, and I do a lot of work now with personality science. That's the personality type. So as long as I appreciate this is how they're gonna want to communicate, if I want to have a conversation, I need to choose to adjust my conversation so that it is heard by them. Then we can actually get in conversation. Otherwise, it's like brick wall, right?
I've spent a lot of years doing advocacy for mental health because what I didn't go into is that all of our boys were then diagnosed as teenagers with severe mental illnesses. Autism is not a mental illness. I always want to separate the two. They just happen to have both. My husband and I got married, and we created unicorns. That's just we did. We didn't know it, but we were going to do that, but we did. But what I have to say is, and I've also done a lot of advocacy for autism, I am cautious when I advise people who are in these relationships, especially when you have neurotypical and people who are not neurotypical together. You can work together and you can create something that is lasting. My husband and I have been married for 25 years, May 22nd. But thank you. But both have to be willing to work at it. Because what I experienced early on in my marriage was not intentionally abusive, but it was abusive. And I don't ever want anyone to say, well, because of this, I need to stay in an abusive situation, because that is not healthy. In my case, once my husband found out what was going on, he was excited to change. He finally knew what was going on. And we were able to work together. As I'm coming this way, he's going that way. If that had not been the case, we would not have been able to make it. And so I don't ever want my story to encourage somebody to stay in an unsafe situation, because every situation is different. I'm not encouraging people to leave either. I'm just saying evaluate the situation you're in. Because even when there are reasons, if you are in an unsafe situation, you need to take your health and safety first. Because my mental health was very seriously affected by what happened early on in our marriage, and I had to go through a lot of treatment as in therapy to kind of deal with that and stuff from my early childhood. So I think it's important as caretakers, as people who are prone to give of ourselves and put ourselves on the back burner, and as women, we usually are. We have to consider the cost to ourselves because I got to the point where my two best friends took me out and said, "Christine, you are not okay. You are not okay." When my youngest son was diagnosed as 12, at 12 with schizoaffective disorder, because they couldn't give him a schizophrenia diagnosis at 12, I broke. I lost my words. I lost my ability to, I just functioned, and I was broken. And I was blessed to have two amazing women in my life who said, "Christine, you're not okay." My best friend, she called a therapist who specialized in parents of special needs kids. She made my first appointment because she knew I could not.
Well, I was going to ask, being so strong, how do you do this, right?
Yeah, and that's the key. You can't, I'm not, first of all, strength is not about all the stuff you see that I do. I think real strength is being able to be vulnerable and admit that you can't do it all. Because I did for years try to do it all, and I got myself to a point emotionally and mentally that I was going to be, I wasn't going to make it just because of the amount of pressure I was putting on myself. I didn't even know I was stressed. My first exercises and therapy were reconnecting my body with my emotions because I would be so stressed. I was grinding my teeth down to nothing, and I didn't even know I was that stressed. When you're a caretaker and there's chronic issues all the time, there is an amount of stress that just you don't even realize how much you're carrying. You just it's just every day. You're on 24/7 as a special needs parent. You're listening. You don't know when it's going to end. I mean, even with my kids as adults that are in the house, I still am, as I'm talking to you, I'm listening to make sure nobody's having a meltdown, that one person's escalation is not going to escalate everybody else. And that's what it is. But if
That's
you don't
what it
take
is.
care of yourself, you are going to burn out because we are human. And so, as I'm, what I do is not really all that special. Any mom, if as long as they want, they're a good mom, any mom wants to do what's right for their kids. Any mom is going to do their best. I think what makes you strongest is to back up and say, be honest when you need help, and be honest enough to accept it.
Absolutely. And if you've heard my phone buzzing a few times throughout this interview, it's not that, can she turn her phone off? Yeah, it's my special needs son saying, call me when you can, call me, love you, call me. He just,
Exactly.
they don't get it, right? So
Right.
yes, you're on 24/7, and even if you have a sleepover going on, I have a monitor between my room and his room because I need to know, like, if he's having a seizure, I need to be there in the middle of the night, doesn't matter what time it is, right? So in terms of getting stories out, I love the fact that now, the A, that I'm able to help you share your story today.
Yes, I love it.
Thank you
Thank
for
you.
your integrity and your honesty and sharing and all of those things that very often would have been just, covered up and not spoken about. But I'm also so glad that you're leveraging your capacity for appreciation and understanding to now help other authors get their story out. I certainly found when I was writing my book, which was, a 9-month process, it was
Yes.
really cathartic. It was like I was channeling, because I'm writing every morning after my morning ritual, meditation, journaling, visualization, etc., and then an hour of writing. It was almost like the words that needed to be in the book flowed through me, but it was very healing, very cathartic, and helping others to get their story out. That's powerful. I bet you have such a blast doing that.
I do. I am a firm believer. It was funny when you were talking about how disconnected we've become through technology and things. To me, storytelling is such an integral part of who I am, but I believe it's more than that, that it's an integral part of who we are as humans. It goes back to our very, very earliest humanity. I mean, we're talking all the way back when we were at the very beginning of humanity, and we use storytelling to get from place to place. We use storytelling to pass on our legacies. We use storytelling to connect. And because stories have the capacity to bypass so many of the intellectual blocks and go and make an impression, whether that is in remembering directions, or whether you're, bypassing it and telling your own story and helping others. So to me, to help other women, I mean, I help everyone, but to help people tell their story and get it out to others, I believe is honestly, it just feels like I don't want to say a calling because that sounds pretentious and I don't feel it like that, but I just feel like it's what I'm meant to do because I love it. I really, really love it.
It's a gift. It's a
Right.
passion.
Yes.
You and I talked earlier today and decided we were going to bring a gift forward for the listener.
Yes.
So tell me, what did you bring as a gift for our
As
listeners?
a gift, we have I have a free character sheet, and along with that is a guide. And in the guide, I teach you how to create memorable, strong characters. And then I walk you through the sheet and how to create them so that you can keep track of them. Because quite honestly, when you're writing a 300-page book, you often forget that on page 11, you gave this side character green eyes, and then on page 320, you're going to say they have brown eyes, and you lose track of it all. But it's not, character sheets are not just for fiction. I call them character sheets. They are for, we use them in fiction. But when you are writing your own stories, in a biography, you also need to keep track of the characters of your story. You need to keep track of the outline of your story. Whether you're writing about business or your own story, there are a lot of things to keep track of. In the case of a business book, a character sheet isn't as much. You're going to use an outline. But with if you're telling a biography and you have a lot of different people coming in and out of your life, it is very helpful to have a character sheet for each one. So I have used them when writing biographies. I often do ghostwriting for biography, autobiographies, and it makes life a lot easier. I am the antithesis of an organized person. I have ADHD. I am all over the place. But books are.
Okay. Well, I'm sure the listeners will appreciate that.
Yeah.
And
Did I
how
lose
do
you?
they access that, Christine? I can
We
put
have a
some information
link.
in the show notes, or if you have a link,
We
okay.
do. It's free gift dot. GAA, gift and author, GAA dot pub, like publisher, PUB.
Yes, so free gift
Dot
at oh, free
and
gift
pub, dot GAA dot pub.
dot pub. Okay, awesome. So that's something that is a gift from Christine, and I'm sure that there'll be lots of people listening who will want to keep in touch. I'm also offering a complimentary chapter from my best-selling book. So that's something that you can access also through my website, and you can also access it. I'm just seeing if I've got the link here handy. I will put the link into the show notes as well. So, probably the best information is let's have a look here and see. Maybe I'll put it in afterwards. I didn't have it
Yes.
handy. Oh, here we go. Actually, you can get at it by putting in yvonnesilver.com, which is my website, / free-chapter. So yvonnesilva.com/free-chapter. And that'll give you an opportunity to download chapter 8, which is actually when no words are even required. So it
Nice.
talks about power pauses, how you show up, your energy, your presence, your decisions, and what is it that you can do that people don't even challenge you? So you're not the person walking into the room and people are saying, "Hey, can you grab me coffee?" Actually, I'm chairing the meeting.
Right.
Yeah. So it's been delightful, really, Christine, getting to know more about you, about your beautiful family, about the work that you've been doing, all of that hard work raising and supporting some very, very special people, and the outcome of that, your resilience, your tenacity, and the fact that you're now taking all of that as a special gift to the world to help others to get their message out, I think is truly special. So again, that company is Christine's company that she's the founder of. So Gift and Author. Let me just make sure I'm getting it right here. Gift and Author Publishing LLC. There's more information that will be available about Christine. You can certainly look her up, Christine Skiff, Skiff, if you're listening to the radio show, not looking at the titling for it. But it's been really interesting today, sharing the untold story of a special needs mom turned literary powerhouse publisher. So thank you, Christine, for joining me.
Thank you for
Anything
having me.
lastly that you wanted to add?
Yeah, I think my last thought is, well, first of all, thank you for having me. This has been such a joy. But also for the listeners, don't let society and your circumstances define you, because everything, as women, it is so easy to let everyone else define us, but we define who we are, and we are. When we put our minds to something, we are the creators, so nothing can stop us. And so I love your vision for the show. I am so excited to read your book. And thank you, thank you, thank you for having me.
You're welcome. And just to reiterate, if you missed the title of it, it is available through Amazon as a physical book, an ebook, and also it's available through Or Sound, AWESOUND, as an audiobook. And the title again is Words, Women, and Wisdom: The Modern Art of Confident Conversations. So that is for women who want to elevate their game. So ask for what you want and get it, and use your powerful language to connect with people. So thank you, Christine, for joining me. Beautiful story to share today. And I look forward to keeping in touch and
Yes.
seeing what we can do to raise the awareness for anyone else who's interested in writing their own book, and encourage you to connect if you've been listening with Christine Skiff at Gift as Gift and Author Publishing. Thank you so much,
Thank
Christine.
you. Thank you. Thank you. Have a wonderful week. Thank you.
Have a beautiful day, everyone. Bye for
Bye.
now.